From Austin Film Festival and PRI, this is On Story, a look inside the creative process from today's leading writers and filmmakers. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. On this week's episode, we're bringing you conversations with filmmakers and television creators behind this award season's new releases. Actor Natalie Portman and filmmaker Brady Corbett will discuss their unconventional pop star drama, Vox Lux.
It was such a rare opportunity to get something that has a character like this on the page.
Ben is back. Writer-director Peter Hedges will discuss the heart-wrenching effects of addiction and working with his son, Lucas Hedges.
You either know someone who's gone through it or your family's going through it. Hopefully this is one of the stories that will show it in a way that will expand your compassion.
And creator Justin Marks will discuss his mind-bending espionage series, Counterpart, which is currently in its second season on the Starz Network. On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI will be back in a moment. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. Vox Lux is the new film from actor-turned-filmmaker Brady Corbett. The movie follows the rise and turbulent career of a pop star that is catapulted to stardom after surviving a violent teenage tragedy. Austin Film Festival's senior film program director Liz Mims spoke with writer-director Brady Corbett and star Natalie Portman after a screening of Vox Lux at the Austin Film Festival. Trailer of Vox Lux, courtesy of Neon and Bold Films Productions, LLC.
Hi, everyone. Let's give him a round of applause for such a mesmerizing film. Truly unique. Something you don't see every day. It is quite a film. And just to sort of kick things off, Brady, for you, what was the seed? What was the start of this story for you?
My previous film was a film that was sent at the beginning of the 20th century. And when I was done with the film, I was quite sick of the subject matter. And the film was set in Europe in 1919. So I wanted to try and jump to the other side of the century, the beginning of this one. And that's how it started. I mean, in all honesty, it was sort of in reaction to what I'd made before.
And Natalie, in reading the script, was there a specific moment that you found in it that kind of convinced you to take on this role?
Well, it was such a rare opportunity to get something that has a character like this on the page. I mean, she's such an original, wild character that just leapt off the page. And in the context of a film that was felt like such a reflection of the moment we live in a way that I hadn't seen before, that it was that combination of sort of this character and then the content of the story.
Can you talk about sort of the writing and kind of going with this unconventional story structure?
For me, the best period of movie making was the first 20 years of cinema. The reason being that there were no rules. It was totally defiant, completely punk rock. They were telling stories based on images. I think that at some point along the way, that the sort of three-act structure became the status quo, and I totally understand why it did, because it's really satisfying. But, of course, like in the same way that you can make a beautiful piece of music that is 15 minutes long or 2.5 minutes long, in the same way that you can paint a portrait that doesn't have a recognizable sort of human expression on it, but it's still a portrait. I feel like it's important that we push to the right and the left of those boundaries. And I felt that because everyone is so familiar with the cliches of a rise and fall story, that to omit 15 years from the character's life was really a totally normal thing to do, because we're all familiar with the sort of inevitability of a story like this, so we know what's made this character this way. So that was the approach.
Natalie, for you, you mold into the character of Celeste beautifully. Can you just give us an insight into developing your character? You've, you know, obviously received a lot of fame on a very different path, but kind of in your own life or piecing together this character, can you talk about that sort of development?
Well, first of all, it was just so fun. Like, she was so fun to be her. I had a good time, and I think that was a big part of it, of creating her. And of course, you know, we had the experience of recording the music, so I kind of got a taste of what that was like and of learning the choreography and working with all these dancers who had been doing, like, Beyoncé's tour and getting to talk to them about what that was like. And then, you know, watching all the documentaries, and there's a lot of them out there, so you get little details here and there from all those different characters. But primarily, I think it was just the script. The character is so specific in the writing that it was, it just gave a very, very clear roadmap.
Yeah, and Brady, for you, like, writing young versus old Celeste, did you spend some time
Thanks for calling me old Celeste.
No, sorry. Were there certain things that you kind of took into consideration in, like, sort of writing this character in two very different, you know, moments?
The idea was that part one would be impressionistic, the second part of the film would be expressionistic. The idea was that you would have a character that was almost kind of absent, you know, waiting there for an idea to plant and fill them up. And then in the second half of the film, that person's kind of overgrown. And it really was like, it was written like that. The thing that's funny about the screenplay is that, and it was written this way on purpose, it didn't delineate like a younger version of the character and then the adult version of the character. Part of the reason was that I knew that financiers would be so put off by the idea that the protagonist doesn't show up for 55 pages. So I didn't want to remind them of that. So I was like, we'll call her one name for the duration of the screenplay. But of course, it was something that we discussed with everyone else. But no, I mean, they're really supposed to be two different characters. I mean, I think and I hope that's sort of evident in the style of the film. They needed to be far apart enough that it felt like a decision. The idea is that there are certain pieces of dialogue and certain parts of the performance that sort of recall the character in part one, but pretty infrequently, so that you have moments in the second half of the film where you go, oh, that's right, there's something before all of this.
And Natalie, were you ever on set during Raffi's sort of, you know, her performances? Did you take a look at any of that footage, or not so much?
I did not see any of Raffi's footage before working, but I was obviously working with Raffi from day one, so it was incredible to get to have that relationship and then get to see in the film her playing the younger version of the character I had played for the first time, and to see how beautifully she was able to, like, in a very minimalist fashion, create completely different characters.
Yeah, totally.
I thought you were kind of crazy when you were like, I'm going to have her play both roles. I was like, you're going to have the younger me play a different role in the second part next to me? Like, what are you talking about? This is crazy. And then she just did it, and it made sense.
The thing is that it's a very difficult thing to explain to anyone. Why is it important for this actor to play two different roles? And it's something which is so poetic. It's a difficult thing to pitch. I felt that if we have this through line of a character that you sort of mourn the loss of that character, but then they're sort of reincarnated in the second half of the film, that A, it would be sort of fascinating and exhilarating as a viewer. But I also felt that it would sort of speak to the theme of the movie, which is the sort of the cyclical nature of pop culture, of the news cycle, and of families, and the fact that it feels like we're like caterpillars, like we just sort of advance like a little bit, and it takes the rest of us a lot of time to catch up. And that's one of those things that you feel intuitively, and it's actually embarrassing before that thing exists to sort of explain why that might work. But fortunately, there are performers and artisans and heads of department that gamble on you. And this is one of the great satisfactions of the dissatisfaction of making a movie for many years.
I love how you jump from the pivotal moment of her performing and the camera sort of lingering, and we see the camera catch younger Celeste's sort of image, And there's this moment where you recognize that there's some sort of energy and charisma here that's going to lead into something else, which is obviously going to be a change for her life. But for you two, like, how much did you talk about what happened in that time that we don't see?
While we were making it, we were just trying to execute it. I mean, that's the truth is that we had very little time. I mean, an abnormally short period of time to make a film that's this complex.
Yeah.
In terms of choreography, in terms of music, dancing, character, you know, ambition for each scene. So we mostly, I mean, with Rafi, with Stacey, with Jennifer, with Jude, with Natalie, I mean, everybody kind of already understood it. So we were more talking about how do we execute the best version of this really wild sequence.
A little bit just about the music in the film and the research you did for that. I mean, it flows so nicely. It fits perfectly. How, like, can you speak to your, like, kind of coming to these particular songs and the music process?
You know, Sia is a very unusual pop star because she's an adult. And most pop stars are not adults, and she's an adult. And so she's been making music for a long time. And when it came to a discussion of we need a synth sound from the early 2000s, from the late 90s, that was actually something that was in her wheelhouse because she'd been making music around that time too. The way that the movie functions, it's kind of hard, so the movie doesn't place a lot of emphasis on it. But the style of pop music in part one and part two is quite different. And we use different synths, different samples, different... in the same way that the characters age, it's subtly or strangely. And I think that... So we were trying to use the music to talk about two different contemporary periods.
And for you, singing and dancing and doing all the things, how was that?
It was really fun.
It looked hard.
It was hard and fun. And I learned how much magic those music producers can make because what I started with did not sound like what it ended like. I can promise you that. They are really geniuses and have a lot of tools at their disposal. And then the dancing. And my husband choreographed it, which was a great gift from Brady that we got to work together again and got to work at home together making this, which was really fun.
I mean, thank God it was that convenient. Otherwise, it would have never gotten done. It was a 13 and a half minute dance sequence that we were supposed to shoot in a day and a half.
Oh, my God. Wonderful. So the film comes out in New York and L.A. pretty soon here. I think it was November 7th?
December
7th. December 7th. I'm sorry. Close. Not this month, but close. What were you saying?
No, that's right. December 7th.
Okay. December 7th. I was almost right. Let everyone you know about it. And let's give them a round of applause, you guys. What a wonderful film. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you all.
So, from the public's perspective, this has been an emotional few years for you. Can you tell us what audiences can expect from the new album?
This is a culmination of my life's work so far. I was under a lot of stress after my accident. But that's what the show is about. It's about rebirth.
So tell me, how many of you have cried yourself to sleep at night? People have been trying to take me down for years. But I won't stay down.
On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI, we'll be back in a moment. Austin Film Festival's On Story is supported in part by Final Draft, industry-standard screenwriting software that now includes extensive story planning tools. Find out more information about Final Draft 10 at finaldraft.com. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. Filmmaker Peter Hedges has written stories as a novelist, a playwright, and a screenwriter. His film credits include What's Eating Gilbert Grape, About a Boy, and Pieces of April. His newest film, Ben is Back, explores the relationship of a mother and her estranged teenage son, who is battling addiction. The film stars Julia Roberts and Hedges' real-life son, Lucas Hedges. I spoke with Peter Hedges after a screening of Ben is Back at the Paramount Theater during the Austin Film Festival. Clips of Ben is Back, courtesy of Roadside Attractions and LD Entertainment. So Peter's been here before with Pieces of April.
Yes,
and of course, you guys should all know What's Eating Gilbert Grape, which was shot around here. And my favorite film, also About a Boy. Just love that one. So this is, I felt like when I saw this that I was on a ride at some weird Disney World, because the energy you feel as an audience member is like you're on a manic ride with somebody who's actually, you know, a person who's addicted. And I don't think I'd ever had something like that come off a film. When you were thinking of this story, what were you trying to make us as the audience really feel?
I was hoping that you would get some sense of what one day can be like for a family that is in the throes of this horrible disease. And I'm not a writer of thrillers or movies that have a kind of an engine like this. And nor did I even think it's what I was writing. I just wanted to try to capture what a day might be like. It's obviously an unusual day. It's not just any day. I think that was it. My hope was that anybody who's gone through this or going through this would feel seen and heard, even though each story is completely unique. But all families dealing with the disease of substance use disorder are kind of all the same in a way. And yet each family is unique. Is that Tolstoy or who said that about families, happy families? It's kind of the same here for that. So I wanted that. And then when I found the end, or the end found me, because I thought I was going to a different end, then it just felt like the first real breath you should take in this movie is the last one. That felt kind of right. And there's a lot of questions I get, I'll just preempt them, about the end. And in anticipation of that, I just want to say that for me, I thought it was going to be different. But when I got there, I had the same experience I had when I was writing Gilbert Grape, where I thought it had a different ending. And then I was writing and I realized, or it realized me, that no, this is where it needed to go.
So the hope part of the story, I think, is really clearly owned by the mother role. And that seems like it's in overdrive all the time, which, you know, was really an incredible experience to watch that. Again, in you were sitting down to write it, not planning to write a thriller, but yet you did. I mean, there were times where you're literally on the edge of your seat in there, and then you're laughing, and it felt wrong a little bit to be laughing, but there are some just blatantly funny things in there and also uncomfortable. The pacing of this is magnificent, you know, and my thought is, what did that look like on the page? How were you going through this process of writing it and editing it and rewriting it and rewriting it? And
I didn't realize till I sent it to a producer friend, Nina Jacobson. I used to work for her at Disney. She's a giant. She produced Crazy Rich Asians with her partner, Brad. And she also had produced The Hunger Games after she left Disney. And I sent her the script because she's one of my favorite people in the business, and I wanted her to see what I'd written, never thinking that she would produce a movie of this size. It's smaller than what she normally does. And she read the script. I remember I hit send, and about 94 minutes later, I got a text back, and then she called, and she said, I have to produce this film. And I said, no, I'm going to send it out next week to producers who make this kind of movie. And she said, no, I really need to produce it. She said, I couldn't stop turning the pages. And again, there was no intention to write that. All I tried to do was be true to the characters, true to what Holly is trying to do. I didn't know when I started writing. I thought Ben was just going to disappear and be gone for the half of the movie. But then when it used to be that they were just going to steal the presents, and then he was going to go try to find the presents. But I was like, so what? I mean, you can replace presents, but you can't replace a dog. And then I was talking to a person who was a mentor to me in this, and she told me a story about someone in her life whose dog had been stolen by their drug dealer. And then I kept hearing about people who had their dogs stolen. And I was like, this is apparently happens. And it became a nice engine for the second half of the movie. The myth of Orpheus was a big guide for me. I used to shun the notion of some kind of precedential story. You know, everything's got to be original. It's like, no, what the hell am I thinking? You know, find Orpheus or the prodigal son, my favorite biblical parable. Both of those were very informative. But mainly for me, it was finding, I wanted it to be a love story. And love blinds us. If you've ever been in love, you do get a little blind, you know. And what really helped me in writing this was that I loved what both of them were trying to do. I don't like a lot of how Holly executes things. I think if she needs to get to Al-Anon, she needs to do all sorts of things to not make some mistakes she made. But I do love that she doesn't give up. And I love, you know, that she really is going to do all she can. But this is such a big disease. It's bigger than any person. So you need a lot of help and a lot of, you need a connection to a higher power probably to get through this. And so there was that. But I also loved that Ben's ache to write his life, to turn his life around, was very moving to me. And it's so much easier to write when you're rooting for the people. For me, I just can't write people that I don't believe in what they're trying to do. And I really like characters that are broken, that are messy, that make big mistakes. I think that's why we go to the movies or we will look for stories, is we want to see people do the things that we in our worst days would do or on our best days would hope we would do. But that's what we want to see. So that's all. Just try to be true to them and you know, the same way I would hope I would be true to you if we were close friends.
So how emotional an experience was it for you to write this and then to direct this?
Well, it was thrilling to write because I had spent so long not listening to the true aches in my heart. And once I committed to this, it was a very exhilarating writing process. I wrote the first draft in 5 weeks and 5 days. I gave myself 6 weeks. I did a 2-week rewrite and another 2-week rewrite, and I sent it to Julia. She said yes, and we were filming in 10 weeks. So it went very fast. But I realized that, you know, it's not hard to write when you're writing the story you're supposed to write. I was once with Oliver Platt when we were touring for Pieces of April, and he said this really beautiful thing about acting. And at the time, I was the first writer on The Devil Wears Prada, a movie that you've probably seen and love, and it's so good. And one of the greatest things that ever happened to that movie was I left it. But I think my Devil Wears Prada, I think would have been amazing, but I think about 8 people would have seen it, and I would have been 5 of them. You know? But they asked him once, they said, what's the truest thing you know about acting? They said to Oliver Platt, we were being interviewed by The Washington Post, and he said, well, it's the only thing I know about acting, or the thing I most know about acting. And he said, what is it? And he said, if I'm working too hard, I'm doing something wrong. And I gasped. I went, and I said, you'll have to excuse me. And I galloped out of the interview and called my producer and my agent and said, give me the words, because I think I'm trying too hard on Devil Wears Prada. And I left that project. But it was not hard to write this movie. It was hard to research it, because it was all born out of the death of my favorite actor ever and a good friend, and both of whom died, and then a family member who nearly died. And I had grown up in a family riddled with addiction. My mother, God rest her beautiful soul, I didn't really know her sober till I was 15 years old. And then I knew her for 22 years until she died, and she was the most amazing, remarkable being. And the woman who walked out on my family when I was 7, that was not my mother. That was a woman consumed by a disease, the disease of alcoholism. And it has informed and shaped everything I do in my life, how I live, why I don't drink, why I've never done drugs. That's beside the point. It's shaped not only her drinking did it shape my existence and why I think I can write a family that's in this throes of this, but also the beauty of her recovery and seeing. And it, I think it gave me a hope in people that is, I think, a bit uncommon, that I just really saw this remarkable person emerge that I didn't know. And she was there before the disease took her over. And people said, well, that was her choice. It was her choice. No, no, my mother, when I knew my mother sober, that woman would never walk out on four children. But people who are in the throes of this do things that are not them. But I wanted to shine in an active sense. I wanted to shine a light on that, because you're either know someone who's gone through it, or your family's going through it, or you don't know someone and you haven't maybe seen it in a way. Hopefully this is one of the stories that will show it in a way that will maybe expand your compassion for what we're going through, because it's big. It's impacting everything in our country right now. So
how was it to?
Oh, sorry.
To direct,
yes.
Lucas.
Yes, yes. Well, what an answer, right? What was it like to work with Lucas? Okay.
That's incredibly personal.
Well, I thought about my mom and dad a lot. My father was a minister, Episcopal priest, for 58 years, and devoted a lot of his life to working with people and families dealing with these issues. My mother, when our older son was a week old, I was directing a play off Broadway, and one day off, it was a very brief run, and I got a call that my mother had a heart attack. And so I went racing to the hospital, because she lived in New York, and I was trying to beat the ambulance there. I lived right near the hospital. I ran there, and I got there, and outside of the hospital was a doctor, and he said, "You must be Carol's son." And I said, "How do you know that?" And he said, well, I should tell you that for many years, my mother worked in the Haight-Ashbury in San Francisco in the free clinic, helping people with alcoholism and drug addiction. And he said, 12 years ago, I was an addict living on the streets of San Francisco, and your mother brought me coffee every day. And she kept bringing me coffee and coffee and coffee. And one day she said, "I may have an idea of something that may help you." And I got clean, and I went to medical school. And now I'm a doctor at this hospital. And 12 years ago, your mother saved my life, and now I'm standing here waiting to help save hers. It's a true story. Maybe I should make that as a movie, but...
We're going to open up to some audience questions. Okay,
sir?
So I'm going to repeat it so everybody can hear it. So,
let's repeat that.
Wants to know why all of the church-like imagery and references really to biblical stuff in the film, in this film?
Well, one, it's Christmas. Two, it's Christmas. You know, it was funny. My wife, when she read the first script, because it was started in a church, was really like, why do you have to start in a church? So I said, it has to start in a church. I don't know why, but it has to. But I have a fix. So then I rewrote it. So Julia's character says, "Do you want to come to church every Sunday?" So that big assist to my wife. But to me, you know, and the final scene is basically a manger in a stable. I mean, if you think about it. I wasn't conscious of that. I liked the idea of the public self. And church is something that does happen for a lot of people on Christmas. It's a time when we show up and we dress up and we try to give the appearance that we're all together. I also felt like I knew I wanted to have a moment where Ben just is exposed and raw. And I was a little worried, I think, for a while. It was a little on the nose. But we watched it, that scene today, and the sound check and the picture check. And I was like, no, that's pretty happy with that. I don't know if I have a better answer for it, except it just felt true to Christmas.
That scene
when they do go to the mall, which I think is going to be up there with one of my favorite movie scenes, is when they're in the room trying on the clothes. And
yeah, that's my favorite scene in the film for a myriad of reasons, because we shot that whole thing in 4 hours after a big snowstorm, and it was supposed to be two scenes, and we made it one. And I just love when she screams at the people, "What the f*** are you looking at?" Sorry for the language, but I just, Julia Roberts saying that was so divine.
Well, you did.
But I also love the performances of both of them in that scene. Just what's going on with Lucas at the beginning of that scene when he's trying on the coat and there's so much danger?
These will both complement your complexion, which is a gift from your mother. You're welcome. Coat, please.
Okay, nice.
I'm good.
Come on. No, this is love. All right, free to go.
You didn't check my shoes.
That's not funny.
It was a joke, Mom. Mom, it was
funny.
A joke.
Excuse me. Can I get a key to this door, please? Unlock the door, Ben, right now.
And I kind of, because I made Ben sober at the beginning, that kind of wonderful acting challenge of being high, and that I haven't seen Beautiful Boy, that I bet Timothy just crushes in Beautiful Boy, which I cannot wait to see. You know, I knew that wasn't going to happen for Ben because he's not going to be able to be dope sick in a day. But I did love that's why I created Spider, because I felt like some people don't understand, and I didn't fully understand, that heroin addicts are mostly using heroin not to get high. They get so sick, they're in so much agony. I was talking to someone who is in recovery, and they said, how bad do you think it feels when you're dope sick? And I described it as the most horrible thing. And with tears in his eyes, tears rolling down his face, he said, it's 100 times worse. So no wonder people are committing crimes and giving up their children and doing all sorts of unthinkable things, because they're in so much agony, so much physical agony, that it's unimaginable. And a lot of people got hooked because they were given painkillers and they had no idea. That's how they got their introduction. They are way overprescribed, and they're way overused, and they misled us. And they got a bunch of people hooked, and there should be a lot of people in jail. That's another movie. Oliver Stone needs to make that movie, but anyway.
Okay,
yes,
question
sorry.
Right here, and then I'm going to repeat it after you. Uh-huh. So the question is, was there a shift in the cinema? Photography direction?
For me, the big shift is in the very first frames, or very still, and on sticks, and then the minute Ben enters, we're pretty much handheld most of the movie. So I think the feel may be less the camera work. It's not that we did a different camera, had a different camera strategy. The idea was that I wanted it to feel like we were peeking in, peering in on life. Stuart Dreiberg, who is our DP, who's a really brilliant DP. A lot of this movie is about point of view. I thought for a long time it was only going to be Holly's point of view, but we live a lot in Ben's point of view, and we decided to shoot wide, which I'd never done on a film, but I really liked it ultimately.
Austin Film Festival's On Story is supported in part by Final Draft, industry standard screenwriting software that now includes extensive story planning tools. Find out more information about Final Draft 10 at finaldraft.com. On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. We'll be back in a moment.
Yeah.
This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. We're back with writer-director Peter Hedges. His new film, Ben is Back, explores the relationship between a mother and her teenage son, who unexpectedly arrives back home from rehab over the Christmas holiday. When we left off, Hedges was discussing the personal connection he felt to the characters and the subject matter, and how actors Julia Roberts and Lucas Hedges helped strengthen his writing.
For me, the key is always, in the films, the stories I tell, it's all about character. It's about what they would do. And there were instances where I wanted them to say more and do more, but my actors would say, that feels like the writer talking. So in some instances, they helped me, Lucas and Julia especially, say, we don't need that. Another instance, I'd written a monologue for the homeless woman, where she basically said, where were you in the 70s when it was crack? Now it's a disease, but it wasn't a disease back then. And there's a whole chunk of our population that should be really angry. And we should all be really ashamed that now it's a disease, but it wasn't then. But at that point in the story, it felt like I was giving a speech. So it's trying to have an honest relationship with each moment and say, is this moment motivated? Now, some people would say, she ran into the doctor at this moment. I've had people say that. That seemed a little convenient. Yeah, I guess it is. It's convenient. But I run into people in the mall, and she might not have seen him. And maybe she's emboldened, and maybe I could have done it better. But that was a very important moment for me, that Holly goes at this guy. And I think the thing is, you know, I'm the son of a minister. He preached sermons. I just don't want to sermonize. At the same time, I tried to understand what I could show in a way that might expand your experience of, oh, really? That's how people got hooked? People got hooked because of pain meds? I didn't know that until I started burying people, going, wait a minute, he didn't drink. No, he didn't drink, but he got on these pain pills and never got off them. I never knew. And so that became interesting. So I think it's a question of what you like and what you want. And I didn't want to preach, except I did want to invade your thoughts and make you think about things maybe you don't think about. It's also working, you know, the beauty of making film and why I'm a novelist primarily, but I don't write novels now. I just want to make films. It's because I love what other people bring. I love that you asked about Stuart Dreiberg. He impacted this film in such a meaningful way. So many people on this film impacted choices I made. I had strong ideas, but somebody comes in and says, we don't need that scene. We reordered some of the scenes in the second half to make it a little more, even though I think the script read really well, there were some things that just didn't make sense. Like, she didn't go to the pharmacy right after she got the thing. She went much later. Well, why? She would go right away. And so when we flipped that, you know, but that was my editor said, what if we try this? And I'm like, that's a really good idea. I'm going to take credit for it. You know, okay,
another question.
Yes, I always imagined that there would be a stepfather. I did not initially imagine that the father would be a person of color and that there would be a mixed race children. That came out of a desire. I always try in my films to normalize some things that, you know, 20 or 30 years ago you would have made a whole film about. Like, we had Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, 30, 40, now it's like 50. Yeah, that's how old I am. It's 50 years ago. But, you know, when I talked with Julia, I said, what if we got Courtney B. Vance to do the movie? And she said, I love him as an actor. And I think, she said, I think that Holly would definitely marry Courtney B. Vance. And I said, then let's go get him. And he signed on. And that, the only real rewrite I had to do two things. Well, one, I had to do, Ben used to describe how unfortunate looking Neil was. And that didn't quite work with Courtney B. Vance. It's like, you're totally uncredible now as a character, Ben, because he's very handsome. And then it seemed like there was an opportunity for that line where he says, if he were black, he'd be in jail. And regrettably, that's probably true. And that was just important to me, and we found a way to phrase that and make that work. I also like the idea that she, you know, she had a past that was a little tougher, and now she's got a good thing going, And that, you know, in my experience with step-parents, I had a stepmother who could see very clearly, and that they're often the smartest person in the room because they're not caught up in the biology of it or the heredity of it all or the origin of it all. They come in with some clarity, and I felt like Courtney really brought that. It's a really astonishing performance. I didn't give him enough, and he brought so much more than I could have ever dreamed. And so I don't think you're aware of how, as much as, you know, what he was able to do with the little he had. He's a brilliant actor.
Yeah, but the relationship with the stepchildren actually gives Ben so much more. I mean, he's more endearing even, you know. I mean,
yeah.
It's hard not to look at him as somebody who's so charming and, you know, where you can see how it works for him, you know.
Yeah, well, that's been my experience with all the people in my life who struggle in this way. They're astonishing. They're really compelling, interesting, vital people. And I wanted to capture that too. I thought, I hadn't seen that. I hadn't seen a person who was kind of getting it together, and then we watched that get pulled at. We're going to talk about Ivy as a character. One of the things that Catherine did in her audition, I was about to cast someone else, but her audition was staggering, was something that was important to me, was I felt her incredible love for Ben and concern for Ben, and that a lot of what's driving her throughout the movie isn't petulance or being a bratty teenager, which easily could be how that felt, but that she's really concerned and selfishly too. She also thinks my senior year of high school is going to get completely ruined and our family, we've done this before. What I hoped to see and find, and it was, there's a moment in the movie when she says go, she whispers go. That was not scripted, but we found it. I was having trouble getting Julia out the door and ending that scene. I had written something that was very melodramatic, and Julia did it beautifully, but it wasn't working, not because of her, but because it was forced concept. I'm really so moved that she would go for it, but it wasn't working. She just needed to leave the room, and then we got there. But then we found this moment, and it was the moment. Because one of the things I needed to find in the story was, and this is what the disease does, it separates us. Holly starts lying throughout the movie. She starts lying a lot. She lies as much as Ben does. And that's what you do. That's what the disease does. We all start lying. And there's even this division with Neil. Now, whether it worked or not, but she's saying he's going to call the police. The assumption is if Ben gets arrested, Ben is going to jail. Ben's probably on some kind of probation. I didn't spell it out. I didn't think I needed to. Maybe I should have. But I think what I wanted you to see in the journey was that ultimately, at the very core of Ivy, was that she's a little girl. Like she's had to be this adult, sometimes for her mother and in the family. She had to grow up quickly. She's that perfect child who kind of is a hero child. But in her very core, she's a scared, terrified person. She's me in the movie. If I'm in the movie, I'm Ivy. So maybe in that way, I missed some beats. But what I had hoped to do and what I feel Catherine did in beautifully was render a very complex set of feelings. I despise you. I love you. I won't know what I'm going to do if I never see you again. In that last moment of hers, which is, you know, she's saying, go to bed. We're going to be, we'll be home in the morning. Just devastates me.
Okay. Here's the deal, and it is not negotiable. You get a day.
Are you sure?
So long as you pass the drug test I'm about to administer, stay clean while you're here, and that this time tomorrow you are back in sober living.
Yeah, okay.
Now, I'm not done. These are our terms, and I don't give a if you hate these rules. You do not leave my sight ever. You do not close the door to your room, where, by the way, I will be sleeping on the floor. And if you try to sneak off, if your bed so much as makes a squeak, I will be all over you, because for the next 24 hours, you are mine, all mine. Got it?
I got it.
Here's the thing I would say. My mother, I would go to AA meetings with my mom. She's passed. She wouldn't mind I say this. I went to many meetings. My mom was like one of the great speakers in AA. She was a rock star in AA. She would speak at a meeting in San Francisco. There'd be 1,000 people there. And they would ask my mom to speak. And whenever she took me to a meeting, one of the traditions is you tell your story. You tell your story. And one of the ways you articulate experience, strength, and hope is I'm there and I say, I'm Peter, and this is what I did, and this is how I got where I am. But whenever I went to a meeting with my mom, she never told her story. And it wasn't until after she had died, many years later, I woke up in the middle of the night and I went, I had one of those middle of the night moments. I have these a lot, but this one was quite impactful. I just went, and I went, and I hadn't figured it out. She didn't want me to know her story. She did not want me to know. She was so ashamed of some of the things she did. She did horrible, horrible things. The disease in her did horrible things. And she didn't want me to know. And I thought, in my own way, that once I realized the dog got taken and it was stolen and Ben needed to get the dog back, and the only way he could get the dog back was with his mother's help. He doesn't have a car. What's he going to do, walk around town? They needed each other to get this dog. But the only way that could happen is if he had to tell her things that my mother never wanted to tell me. So it's no secret. It's no secret that people all over the world right now in America are giving their bodies to people to get drugs. It's happening down the block right now in this town. It's happening everywhere. That didn't take much to figure out. And I just decided to make it something very close. It's no secret that, you know, people are going out and two people are using and one person dies and the other doesn't. And you know, so that made sense. And so anyway, I just tried my best to find a way to make it as organic and as true as it can. Some people really trip up on the second half of the movie. I've had people say, you know, why couldn't it stay in the first half? And they said, well, but the second half is, that's where you go, you know. The woman who counseled me on this film said that she could walk out this door anywhere in America. She could walk out this door and in 2 minutes she could score. And the other thing that shocked me was she said, with 30 years of recovery, like the strongest recovery I've ever met in a human being, she said, if you put a heroin packet in my hand right now, and you put it in my hand, and you left me alone, I'd shoot it up as quick as I could. It's how powerful it is. It's that powerful.
Starr's original spy series, Counterpart, follows a multi-dimensional story of a Berlin-based United Nations agent who is thrust into a shadow world of intrigue and danger when he discovers a crossing into a parallel dimension. The series stars Academy Award winner J.K. Simmons in a dual performance as Howard Silk and Silk's near-identical doppelganger. Austin Film Festival's film competition director, Harrison Glazer, spoke with creator Justin Marks at the Austin Film Festival. Clips of Counterpart, courtesy of Starz Network.
30 years ago, during the Cold War, there was an experiment. Something went wrong. They opened up a passage.
When you go through this door, you come out the other side, you're in another world. Identical to ours.
There was one reality, and then it duplicated. We share genetics, childhood. I want to know how you became so different.
I think Counterpart came from a lot of things. I grew up on the books of John le Carré and Graham Greene, and always wanted to do a show that had that tone, that was like an espionage show, but was more about the characters, was more about people sitting on benches and speaking in code, and it was nuance and lived in. But not having really grown up, or been an adult, I should say, in the Cold War, I knew I didn't really have a story or anything to add to that genre or era of the Cold War kind of British spy thrillers. So the idea of this science fiction twist came in where we took the Berlin Wall and turned it into more of a metaphysical construct, a divide between two equal realities that were once identical and now have kind of grown apart. And then ultimately, you know, the story became, and really, you know, at the beginning it was just a lot of, it's funny, I actually cracked open an old notebook for the first time since like before the first season writer's room opened, and it was like my one page pitch sheet for Counterpart. And it's really interesting to see what the show was before the room and then to think about what the show is now. I mean, generally it's the same, but the specificity of it and the details and the questions that we started to, you know, really brainstorm out over the last couple of years, I think are kind of amazing. But ultimately, at the beginning, all I knew was that the show should be about what if, right? It should be about being able to be confronted with a version of your life unlived, and then what that would do to you if you saw that version of your life, and if you saw that other person who you had become, would you like that person? Would you get along with that person? Would you hate that person, resent that person, dislike all that person's little quirks that you share?
So you have this world in your head and these questions are in your head. Was it always a TV show? How did you originally want it structured?
At the very beginning, I actually was starting to write it as a feature. I had the first 25 pages of the first episode was already written, you know, just because it was something in my head and I wanted to write it. And then when the studio, MRC, got involved, they were the ones who convinced me that, you know, this would be a good long-form show. I think at that time, which really is starting to date how long we've been making this show, considering we're just like premiering the second season, Breaking Bad was really in its heyday, and wanting to do something that showed a trajectory like that, but in our case with Counterpart, to show kind of two shadow trajectories of each other between both versions of Howard Silk, who J.K. Simmons plays. So that was where it became interesting to tell that in long form.
Well, so let's talk about the world, and I guess the collaboration in building the world.
At the beginning, there was no world. There was really just these two characters who I thought it would be fun to sit around each other, but everything they talk about, from like someone's killing people and there's a coup d'etat going on upstairs and management and all these different things, like I had no idea what upstairs was, no idea what management was, no idea why someone was killing these people. We just wanted to have an assassin do stuff in the first episode. Oh, there's a great example, right? Baldwin, you know, the character of the assassin in the first episode was never meant to really survive the first episode. I mean, she did, I guess, by the time the script finally went out, but even then I was unsure about how long we would keep her. I mean, it was really just, she was like, oh yeah, you've just seen that trope of like a cool assassin who can kind of blend in and do things. It wasn't until ultimately The Room where we began talking about this character, this woman of Baldwin, and who she might have been in the other world, that it began to be really interesting, and she kind of took on a life of her own. I also, if I recall correctly, and it was episode 4 that Aaron wrote of season 1, I mean, and I fully cop to this, if it had been up to me, and I guess like the male knee-jerk of it all, we probably would have killed Baldwin in that fourth episode. You know, we had sort of come to the point of like, we know everything that we need to know about her. And so, you know, and now she's being like set up in an impossible situation. Like, maybe it's just her time, you know? And it was the other writers in the room who I think really fought for her and found a way to keep her alive, not just in the episode, but now, you know, she's a regular on our show and she stays on it forever.
On Story is brought to you in part by the Alice Kleberg Reynolds Foundation, a Texas family providing innovative funding since 1979. This project is supported in part by the Cultural Arts Division of the City of Austin Economic Development Department, the Texas Commission on the Arts, the U.S. Institute of Museum and Library Services, and the Texas Library and Archives Commission. This program is also made possible in part by a grant from Humanities Texas, the state affiliate for the National Endowment for the Humanities. The show is produced by myself, Barbara Morgan, our associate producers, Aaron Halligan, Colin Heyer, Sonia McCarter, Vita Gassemi, and Maya Perez. Our editors are Jamal Knox and Randy Reynolds, and our music is by Brian Ramos. Production assistance comes from the Sound Lab, Inc., and KUT 90.5 in Austin. Go to austinfilmfestival.com to find out more about the Austin Film Festival and Conference each October. Until next time, I'm Barbara Morgan, and this has been Austin Film Festival's On Story.
PRI, Public Radio International.